Big show as we wrap things up for you for the month of February on Friday the 28th right here on Connecticut Today. Our buddy Dave Workman checked back in from thegunmag.com to talk about all things guns and Second Amendment in the presidential campaign. He also weighed in on the possibility of a 35% excise tax on ammunition here in Connecticut. And also in the 5 o'clock hour, our weekly check-in, we were back with Stratford Republican State Senator Kevin Kelly, also writes for Liberty Park Press. You've read his pieces in major newspapers like the Chicago Tribune, also the Seattle Times, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Dave Workman joins us again. Dave, welcome back. How are you?
Well, I'm okay for an old guy. I finally stopped laughing at what Joe Biden said the other night.
Poor old Joe. He's you know, Dave, and I know he's supposed to win tomorrow and get creamed on Tuesday. You listen, respect for what the guy did, but it's time for the grandkids, Joe. It's time to just, you know, he wiped out half the country, Dave, with one remark in that debate.
Yeah, I know, and I think it was amusing when his campaign just scrambled to say, oh, well, he meant to say 150,000, but I did a piece in Liberty Park Press yesterday, and I did some math. And the number of people who have been killed with firearms in homicides between 2007 and I think it was 2017 they were getting the numbers from. So you had a 10-year period there. It doesn't come close to the actual 150,000 that he supposed to have mentioned, and it's nowhere near 150 million. But you're right. He literally obliterated almost half of the United States population in about 10 seconds worth of diatribe.
It was some pretty good rapid fire there, huh, in 10 seconds, right?
Well, yeah, and I don't think they make that big of an extended magazine to cover that kind of violence. But I was watching the debate. Now, I was actually working on a story at the time. And he says the remark, and you know, I stopped right in the middle of a sentence, and I said, what? No, he didn't really say that, did he? And later on, when I ran back a clip of the of the debate, he said, oh, my God, I'm there. Oh, no, wait a minute. You know, I got to write about that, and I did. So one thing I got to give Joe Biden. He is guaranteed employment for any honest journalist out there because we're just going to wait until he makes his next gaffe and then write about it again. It's just bizarre.
He likes shotguns, though. He always tells people, you don't need that semi-automatic stuff. Buy a shotgun. Buy a shotgun. So he likes that 12-gauge stuff, I guess, huh?
Yeah, and I went back and I found that clip. It was from, I guess, a YouTube interview that he did several years ago when he's the vice president, and he was advising some young lady about what to, you know, what kind of a gun to get to defend her home. And so he comes up with this goofy idea. Yeah, I tell my wife, just take a double-barreled shotgun outside and fire two rounds in the air. You know, that's either a gross misdemeanor, and in some cases, that's a felony.
Really? I know.
You're in.
You can't go cracking off rounds in the air. That's illegal. You know, Dave, but I one the reason that I think that caught everybody's eye, and I wanted to have one of you folks on, is that I wonder now going forward what role gun politics is going to have, you know, in the race, especially looking back at the fact that, you know, the Democrats are going to try and win back middle America, win back the Rust Belt, win back, you know, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, and all that. You think they're going to go all in on some of this gun stuff, or are they going to tread lightly like, you know, Al Gore had to back about 15, 20 years ago when the whole anti-gun thing just blew up in his face?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people remember Al Gore just blew it when he took that canned goose hunt, and he came out and he was carrying a dead goose, and somebody, some reporter asked him, did you shoot it? And the guy that was with him said, well, yeah, he got it, which I don't think anybody believes. But, yeah, I do think the gun control issue is going to be a big deal, especially with the Democrat race. We've got five or six people remaining in the race. All of them have gun control as a major part of their campaign message, and Michael Bloomberg has spent, I don't know, millions, tens of millions of dollars pushing his gun control record in advertising in most of the states that are going to have the Super Tuesday elections next week. So, it's a big deal. And I just got finished writing a story about the shooting in Milwaukee at the brewery. Well, Milwaukee is going to be the site of the Democratic National Convention in July, and I guarantee you they're going to be talking about that shooting to push their gun control agenda.
Yeah, and again, in that Milwaukee shooting, and again, the guest is Dave Workman from thegunmag.com. You know, Dave, I was doing a little reading about that shooting today. Again, very tragic, a workplace shooting. The guy was a, you know, apparently a legal gun owner, but again, you had a scenario here where the guy apparently had problems, you know, in the workplace here. There were really no telltale signs of it, and it's sad that, you know, people who own guns and friends of mine do, you know, they're going to be labeled by some people, say, oh, well, there you go. If the guns weren't around, this would have never happened.
Well, yeah, and that in itself is a tragedy, because what you've got is a situation where you got about 100 million Americans that are having to take the rap for what this guy did. And at the same time, you've got gun control advocates, including some of the Democrat presidential hopefuls. They're calling for more gun control, like universal background checks. Well, as you just pointed out, Paul, this guy had been a gun owner for several years. In fact, I think probably his whole life. How's a universal background check going to prevent some guy who's owned firearms for decades from doing something, you know, just cracking someday? You can't predict something like that, and you can't say, well, you know, we'd have got him in a background check. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. No, you wouldn't. He already had guns.
And the sad thing is, Dave, I don't know whether you saw this, too, in some of the articles I read about this, he apparently, and again, we're not trying to cast aspersions here or make grandiose pronouncements here, but I guess he had been taking pain medication for several years. He had been on opioids, apparently, to some way, shape, or form with this whole thing. So who knows how that played into it?
Well, yeah, I think there's always at least a reason to look into that sort of thing. If we start playing the Tom Cruise game, you know, where you go out and arrest somebody because he may commit a crime in 10 years, that again is just Twilight Zone stuff. The unfortunate part about this, from what I've read about this guy, he was very well liked. Sure, he had some arguments with people at the workplace. Tell me where that's never happened before. but, you know, it never, very rarely rises to the occasion where somebody just decides to shoot four or five people. That's always a sad thing, but you can't start laying the blame on that for 100 million people whose only crime is that they are exercising their rights under the Second Amendment. But I think that's the game that the gun prohibition lobby is once again starting to crank up as a result of this. And in what Biden said the other night actually plays into this, because I guarantee there are some people out there who honestly believe that 150 million people have been killed with guns since 2007.
Absolutely. Dave, hang on. I want to come back and ask you, Dave, about taxing ammunition. We have a legislator here in Connecticut pushing that, so we'll get more from Dave Workman on that. He edits thegunmag.com, thegunmag.com. More with Dave straight ahead. Traffic and weather together on the sixes here at 416. It's a Friday on WICC. Couple of more minutes with Dave Workman. He's been kind enough to join us on the Friday talking gun politics. He's an award-winning career journalist. Currently is the senior editor at thegunmag.com. And Dave, something that's bubbled up here in Connecticut, you may have seen it for the second year in a row. We have a proposition here in the state that's being bandied about in our General Assembly to lop an excise tax on ammunition. It was floated at 50% last year. That didn't get too far. And there was a committee hearing yesterday, Dave, in Hartford, to do one of 35% or 35 cents on the dollar on ammunition here, the excuse being that the extra money to be raised, something like $7-8 million, they figure is going to go battling gun violence or the cost of gun violence in the big cities. You know, Dave, my basic question on this is, why are law-abiding gun owners paying the bill for criminals? I don't get it.
Well, the whole idea here, I'm pretty sure, is to discourage people from wanting to own firearms because it becomes cost prohibitive. And, of course, doing it that way is unconstitutional. You're actually trying to charge a fee to exercise a constitutionally protected fundamental right.
Mm-hmm.
They've done the same thing here in Seattle, where I'm located, about 5 years ago. And at the time, we predicted that it wasn't going to stop any crime activity at all. And sure enough, the crime statistics from the Seattle Police Department have borne that out. And the tax has never really raised as much money as they predicted that it would. I actually had to sue the city of Seattle under a Public Records Act request. The lawsuit was successful. We forced the city of Seattle to admit that its revenues from that tax came nowhere near what they said that they would get. And here again, I think the most important point is that it chased one gun shop out of the city, taking all that revenue with them, and it hasn't resulted in any reduction in shootings or in homicides involving mm-hmm. firearms. So, you know, this is just, I think it's feel-good legislation that accomplishes nothing except to try to convince some of the folks out there, hey, we're doing something about crime, when you're not really doing anything at all.
Sure, sure. Dave, I know that last time we spoke, I believe it was around the time that we had those key Supreme Court arguments regarding that big New York City case or that New York State case. We're still waiting for a pronouncement on that, correct?
Yeah, and if history is any gauge of these things, if the Supreme Court is going to hand down a ruling on the Second Amendment, it's going to be probably on the last day of the session, sometime in June, when they hand that down, because the High Court has a tradition of waiting until the very last day to hand down controversial decisions. I think it's decided so that the justices can get out of town.
Yeah, because they do that with their cars all running in the back
yeah.
lot, right?
Yeah, but that's been the case when they handed down the Heller decision in 2008, and again with the McDonald ruling in 2010, both of which reinforced the notion that the Second Amendment is protective of an individual right to own and keep and bear arms. That was on the last day that those rulings came down. So the longer this goes on, the longer I think, or the more likely it is that the court is actually going to hand down a ruling, and it's going to be devastating to the gun control crowd, and it's going to come out on the last day of the session sometime in June.
Check out his stuff, folks, on thegunmag.com, thegunmag.com. Dave Workman joining us again from Seattle. Dave, always good to hear from you. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Well, you bet. Nice joining you.
Thanks. Dave Workman there from thegunmag.com. And, of course, the Supreme Court case we're talking about, lawsuit filed against the city and state of New York, I believe. And what that case is alleging is that the Second Amendment rights of people who just wanted to go target shooting in the area in New York were violated because of a ruling that prohibits or tightly prohibits how guns can be transferred in vehicles and carried in New York. Well, apparently New York State saw this coming. They went out and they changed the law, but the Supreme Court may rule on this anyway to set a precedent for other cities and towns and states that may try to pull a fast one like this. So once again, check them out, folks, thegunmag.com. For GOP State Senator Kevin Kelly about the goings-on or not up at the General Assembly. Kevin, how are you? Everything good?
I'm doing pretty well, Paul. Yourself?
I'm hunkering down here. I'm all good. Well, we're a few days into the short session, Kevin. We've had some rather interesting public hearings. I know we had the public hearing and the big committee vote, the 14-11 vote on the religious cutout for vaccinations. That's on the table. Gambling still on the table. Sports gambling. I know there's a big public hearing coming up on that next week. I know there was a hearing yesterday, Kevin, on this 35% excise tax on ammunition. So you folks got a lot on your plate up there for the short session. What do you ascertain so far?
Well, what I'm seeing is, and you saw it also with tolls, is that there's a lot of progressive radical ideas going on that are really, I'm going to say, energizing the Connecticut citizenry to become engaged and to speak out and to let their voices be heard, whether it's a 22-hour public hearing on the vaccinations. The hallways were lined with individuals lining up yesterday on the ammunition tax, a 35% excise tax, the threat of tolls to take more money out of middle-class families' pockets and off the kitchen table. There's another one. It's not getting a lot of play yet, but I'm on Children's, and, you know, they want to do away with chocolate milk on kids' menus. And, Paul, the thing that I'm in Hartford, and I think to myself, who is staying up awake at night saying, you know what, we got to get rid of chocolate milk? I mean, that's really the thing that's bad for kids nowadays.
Because Lord knows, Kevin, chocolate milk was never drunk before. You know, how many millions of kids were wrecked physically because they had a carton of chocolate milk at school every day? It's mind-boggling.
Right. And this is what I'm going to say the majority under the dome is focusing on. And it's why I think Connecticut citizens are speaking out and fighting back, is that I think the majority has just lost its way. I think Connecticut families are having trouble economically. We need more jobs. We need a better economy. We need a transportation system that works and can get us to and from our place of employment or recreation safely. Let's start focusing on things that actually matter to families rather than these things that are really government interference and overreach.
Kevin, the short session is supposed to be the adjustment session for the budget. We work on a two-year biennium. So along with all the issues we're looking at, you know, the gun tax, marijuana, whatever, gambling, what are you seeing and hearing as far as the nuts and bolts and the numbers here about what you folks in the General Assembly or the governor may have to do to kind of keep the books even close to being balanced for the next year or so, if that's possible?
Well, what you see, I mean, good example, Paul, is last session, in the long session, we had just a little over 70 bills coming through the insurance committee, and now this year we're having another 70 bills. And the fact of the matter is, once again, you see all these initiatives, there's all kinds of state spending being proposed and advocated for. You're right, this short session is just supposed to be nothing more than, you know, I'm going to say, tinkering with the budget to make sure that we can make adjustments and modifications to keep the state on a fiscal course that's sound. Not to be, you know, like, for instance, there's going to be a public hearing next week on the public option, which will totally transform the health insurance industry in the state of Connecticut. It's going to do away with our health insurance industry, kill, you know, thousands of jobs in the state of Connecticut. And this is what we're going to tackle in a short session. Sometimes you wonder, you know, whether or not they actually read the Constitution.
Kevin, finally, I want to go back to the gambling issue. I got the email. I got an email yesterday with the schedule. I guess is coming up Wednesday. I think is an omnibus hearing with all these bills. Obviously, anything going on in Bridgeport with a third facility is going to affect Bridgeport and your district, your voters in the greater Stratford area. What are you hearing on that? And I know the governor has thrown a couple of, you know, chips, as it were, toward the Indian tribes, the Mashantucket Pequots and the Mohegans there, as to whether or not they can have some things in return for running sports gambling and how big this facility would be in Bridgeport. What are you hearing on that?
Well, what I'm hearing is that there, you know, when I walk around the district, there's a lot of groundswell for support for that type of investment in the city of Bridgeport, and I think there's a lot of support locally for this. Also, in the Capitol, I hear that there's a lot of discussion that we would like to move in the direction of gaming and sports betting. But the question is always, you know, whether it's going to be with the partner that we have, which have been the Indian tribes in eastern Connecticut, or whether we're going to look to a new partner in MGM. And Paul, this is one of those questions. You know, you have a new governor. He came in 13 months ago. And, you know, at the end of last session, I know this was an issue that was on the forefront, at least down here in this end of the state, that you would think that the governor would be able to sit down with the stakeholders and hammer out an agreement that would work for everyone, whether it's the partner you have, a partner you may want, or the citizens of Connecticut, and get this done to benefit not only our region but the entire state. And I think it's a failed leadership that we're here. We are, you know, February, 13 months later, and we still don't really know what direction they're going to go to or what's the consequences of anything that they're brokering in Hartford.
Kevin, one of the hang-ups on this, you and I well know, is what would happen to the slot money. And I know the Indians are saying, well, you know, here's 10% more if we get to control sports gambling and everything. But you and I both know, Kevin, you see the numbers up there. I don't, but I do read them, that the monthly take from the slots, it's not just an aberration. It has been a gradual slide now, I think, for a couple of years. Is there any thought up there, any serious thought among members to take the risk of saying, hey, walking away from the Indian tribes who have threatened, you know, to yank that slot money and going with another operator? Or is that slot money, in your mind, still too valuable at this point, even though it does seem to be sliding a bit?
Well, the problem with what we have, Paul, is that right now it's about $250 million. And we have this permanent fiscal crisis that Dan Malloy started, that now we have these financial issues. So when we look at if we try to change our partner, what they look at is if the minute we issue the RFP to go in a different direction, the tribes say they would stop. That would break the compact, so they'd start. They'd stop paying us the $250 a year. The time frame between the issuance of an RFP and the opening of a casino is about 3 to 4 years. So we would be looking at about $1 billion of lost revenue, because even if it goes into an escrow account and you have to go to court to get the money, you're going to have to do without it in the interim. And $1 billion is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what I always believe here is, well, I don't understand why the governor can't sit down with both the tribes and the MGM or any other partner and try to work this out. I think there's got to be a middle ground, maybe partnering with both entities to do something in Bridgeport.
Or maybe say to MGM, okay, we're going to give you the agreement, but you got to bond that money to us. You've got to cover, at least, Kevin, right, part of our losses of the slot, maybe not 100% of it, but if you really think you can make a go of it here in Bridgeport, you've got to ante up some of this in advance.
Well, that was one of the questions I had asked, is whether or not they would work with the state to do that, and they weren't so inclined at that time to do it, and that's why I think the state hasn't gone in that direction. But here, once again, Paul, you got to start to look at this creatively. We can't just look at it the way it was. But let's see what options are available that would help the state of Connecticut, both from a fiscal position at the state, but also for jobs in the local economy in Bridgeport and investment in the harbor there. I think, you know, it's a great opportunity, but once again, we don't have the leadership in Hartford that's watching out for the region to make sure that we succeed and flourish.
Kevin, thanks as always. We'll talk to you next week. Have a great weekend.